permanent representative of the Artsakh Republic, Kailar Mikhaelian. Representative of the Ministry of Armenia and Diaspora, Henriette Andreasian. Reverend Fred Nile, Honorable David Clark, MLC. Rabbi Ullman, spiritual leader of the Russian-speaking Jewish community. Jaron Chester, of the Jewish Lobby President. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land and pay my respects to the elders, both past and present. I would now like to welcome the Honorable David Clark, MLC, to give the opening address.
Well, thank you very much. I've actually been asked not to give an opening address, but to welcome people here. I think the opening address is going to be given by a very distinguished speaker. But my name is David Clark. I'm a member of the Upper House. I'm Parliamentary Secretary for Justice in New South Wales. And it's my honour and privilege and delight to welcome you all here to the Parliament of the People of New South Wales. And this is, of course, a lecture organised by the Australian Institute of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, and it's the Armenian Genocide Commemorative Lecture. And we have, from overseas, Kate Nahapetian. Is that the correct pronunciation? And I heard you the other night at Chatswood before, I think, 1,300 people were there. The place was packed. So I welcome especially you here, members of the National Armenian Committee, and members of the Armenian Australian community. Welcome to the Parliament of New South Wales. And in this place we believe in democracy and we believe in freedom and we believe in human rights. And we're going to hear some more tonight about the Armenian genocide. Now there are some people out in the world there who say that it never happened, but you've just been up on the 8th level, and the Parliament of New South Wales has built a memorial, it's been there for some years, which say it did happen. And as far as this Parliament is concerned, it happened, and it's there. And just to make sure, just to make it clear that there's no misunderstanding, not only have we got a memorial there on the 8th level, we about 3 years ago carried another motion to make clear once again that nothing has changed in the meantime since that memorial went up and the Parliament unanimously carried a resolution saying that it did happen. So it's important that we gather here today because there are people out there who want to revise history, who want to invent history, who want to change history, but they say that what happened never happened. But history and the witnesses, those who were victims, and observers, independent observers who were there, say that it did happen. So I'm not going to say any more, but just simply to welcome you, and I'm looking forward to hearing from our guest speaker. As I said, I heard you the other night, and it was riveting to hear you, and we're going to be in for a very, 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 very exciting lecture from you, I have no doubt. Can I also acknowledge Reverend the Honourable Fred Nile, who's the Assistant President of the Upper House. You haven't got a better friend in Australia than the Reverend Fred Nile. He just keeps on going on. So thank you very much for being here. You are always, the Armenian Australian community are always welcome in the Parliament of New South Wales. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Armenian Genocide Commemorative Committee and the Australian Institute of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, I welcome you to the annual Armenian Genocide Commemorative Lecture. Since 1996, with the initiation and sponsorship of the Armenian Australian community in Sydney, the Australian Institute for Holocaust and Genocide Studies has held the annual Armenian Genocide Commemorative Lecture. The lecture is dedicated to the memory of the 1.5 million victims of the genocide of Armenians, perpetrated by the Ottoman Turkish government during World War I and its aftermath. The annual Armenian Genocide Memorial Lecture Series seeks to honour the memory of the victims by addressing human rights issues and contemporary importance, and by providing a constructive role in understanding and preventing genocide and other crimes against humanities. Previous speakers have included Professor Richard Hovhannisyan of the University of California, Los Angeles Professor Vahakan Dadrian of the Zorian Institute, New South Wales Supreme Court Justice John Dowd AO, Barons Caroline, Deputy Speaker of the British House of Lords, Israeli scholar Dr. Yao Aron, Mr. Rafi Hovhannisyan, former Minister of the Republic of Armenia, social commentator and radio presenter Philip Adams, Dr. Sev Ozdowski, OAM, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commissioner Ms. Hilda Tokobian, Director of the European Armenian Federation Aras Safarian, Washington DC and last year's Speaker Mr. Viken Babkenyan, who with his author Professor Peter Stanley launched their book Armenia, Australia and the Great War. We are very pleased to have as this year's Speaker Ms. Kate Nahapetyan, the Executive Director of the newly formed Armenian Legal Centre for Justice and Human Rights. Prior to her posting, she was the Government Affairs Director for the Armenian National Committee of America, where she advocated for the Armenian-American concerns before members of Congress and the administration. Her work included helping coordinate efforts to film amicus briefs for life insurance class actions emanating from the Armenian genocide. In addition to experience as an attorney litigating complex class actions, Ms. Nahapetyan has worked for the US Department of Justice, then Senator, later Vice President Joseph Biden, the Carnegie Endowment for International and Mental Disability Rights International. Ms. Nahapetyan received a JD with a focus on international and human rights law from the University of California at Berkeley School of Law, which was partly funded through the prestigious Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship for New Americans. After graduating with a degree in international studies from the American University, Ms. Nahapetyan received a Konrad Adenauer Foundation Fellowship to pursue graduate studies in Germany. Her publications included Confronting State Complicity in International Law in the UCLA Journal of International Law and Foreign Affairs, and Selective Justice Prosecuting Rape in the International Criminal Tribunals of the Former Yugoslav and Rwanda in the Berkeley Women's Law Journals. Ms. Nahapetyan is a member of the Bar in California and New York. The topic of this year's Armenian Genocide Commemorative Lecture is examining the Armenian Genocide under international law, justice and accountability. Please welcome Ms. Kate Nahapetyan to deliver the Armenian Genocide Commemorative Lecture. Thank you.
Thank you for such a generous introduction. It's a true privilege and honor to be here. So many of the previous speakers are heroes of mine that I have admired their work for so many years. So it's incredible that I'm here now in this position. And I would like to thank the Armenian Genocide Commemorative Committee and the Australian Institute for Holocaust and Genocide Studies for inviting me here. Today I'm going to talk about international law and the role the Armenian Genocide has played in shaping it, and how we can use international law to realize justice. The Armenian Genocide was instrumental in developing international human rights law that we have today that protects us all, whether we're Armenian or not, in Australia, in the United States. Many people think that international human rights law wasn't developed until after World War II and the creation of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But in fact, there are treaties dating back to the 1800s dealing with human rights issues. And in particular, these treaties came about because of the Armenians and the persecution of Christians in the Ottoman Empire. The Treaty of Paris from 1856 was signed between the Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the United Kingdom, and France. It ended the Crimean War, and it called for the Sultan to guarantee the rights of Christian subjects. Before this time, it was considered that the treatment of a country's citizens was a matter for only domestic affairs. But here, this is the start of the development of a human rights consciousness, where people, states are saying that no, the way you treat your own citizens is a matter for other countries, and we are going to try to protect them. But the problem was that although it called for the Sultan to guarantee the rights of Christian subjects, it also explicitly stated that European powers could not interfere in the Ottomans' affairs, domestic affairs. So although it had this fatal flaw, it was a first step towards protecting human rights of the Ottomans' Christian minority. It signified an acceptance by the Ottoman Empire that the treatment of citizens was not purely a domestic affair, that did not have international repercussions. The persecution continued, however. And next you have the Berlin Treaty from 1878. This again was with the Ottoman Empire, the UK, Austria-Hungary, France, Germany, Italy, and Russia. It had some more teeth to it. It provided some more protections for Armenians. Unlike the Treaty of Paris, the Treaty of Berlin explicitly mentioned Armenians. Article 61 stated that the government, quote, engages to carry out without further delay reforms in the provinces inhabited by Armenians and to guarantee their security against Circassians and the Kurds. It stated that the powers will, quote, watch over the execution of these reforms. It did not include that provision stating that the great powers did not have the right to interfere in what was the Ottomans' domestic affairs. It took that provision away. So it enabled the European countries to intervene on the behalf of the Armenians. The problem was that the European countries were not willing to do more than speak in support of Armenians. They were not willing to go to war to protect them. And the Ottoman government saw this, and so they continued with their massacres. And the 1890s Hamidian massacres happened, and they saw yet again the impunity of these mass murders. And it encouraged them to continue. And then you saw that the Armenian genocide started in 1915. Again, the international powers protested the mass murder and deportations of Armenians. A new term was utilized to describe these atrocities. It was, quote, the first time the term crime against humanity was used in an international legal context. In a joint declaration by the Allied powers, Great Britain, France, and Russia in May 1915 condemned the Turkish government for the massacres and annihilation of the Armenian race. In the declaration, they said, in view of those new crimes of, quote, Turkey against humanity and civilization, the Allied governments announced publicly to the Sublime Porte that they will hold personally responsible for these crimes all members of the Ottoman government and those of their agents who are implicated in such massacres. After the genocide came, a flurry of treaties dealing with the Armenians and seeking redress for the genocide and provide justice and protection for the Armenians came about. The most important is the Sèvres Treaty from 1920. Again, you have many international signatories, Turkey, UK, France, Italy, Japan, and Armenia were signatories. The Sèvres Treaty called for the return of properties and the redrawing of borders. Both Turkey and Armenia agreed to the border being determined by US President Wilson, which would be a final decision that could not be appealed. Article 144 of the treaty stated that all property should be returned without compensation to the current owners and irrespective if other people were living on the property. The treaty envisioned an arbitral commission, which would have been appointed by the League of Nations, with one representative from Turkey, one representative from the minority group, and one representative from the League of Nations. The parties also addressed the very real problem of not having heirs. And in that case, the treaty called for the properties to be returned to that community and not the state. The treaty also envisioned reparations not only for individuals, but the Armenian nation. Article 89 called for US President Wilson to draw the border between the Armenian nation and Turkey. The US State Department created a commission which traveled to the region, studied the ethnic demographics, and then proposed a border, which President Wilson then signed. The decision gave Armenia access to the sea. The Treaty of Sèvres was not ratified, unfortunately, but is a crucial treaty documenting that the crimes committed were considered a violation of international law that called for reparations. Because Turkey's irregular Kemalist forces refused to accept the Treaty of Sèvres and rebelled, Turkey was successful in renegotiating the terms of surrender through the Lausanne Treaty. One of Turkey's first defenses against the Treaty of Sèvres is the Lausanne Treaty. Turkey points to the Lausanne Treaty in its attempt to claim that the outstanding issues, in particular Wilson's Armenia, created by the Treaty of Sèvres, were resolved. However, unlike the Treaty of Sèvres, the Lausanne Treaty did not address its border with either Armenia or the Soviet Union. The Lausanne Treaty did delineate Turkey's borders with its other neighbors, but not with Armenia. It couldn't, because Armenia was not a signatory to the Lausanne Treaty. But the treaty that did delineate the borders between Turkey and Soviet Armenia is the Kars Treaty. This is the treaty that Turkey wants an independent Armenia to explicitly accept. The Kars Treaty was not signed by an independent Armenia, but a Soviet Armenia that had been captured and obliterated through a criminal act, the genocide, the crime against humanity. The validity of the Kars Treaty is questionable, however, most notably by Turkey's very actions itself. Turkey's over 20-year blockade of Armenia has invalidated the Kars Treaty, which under several provisions obliges parties to provide an open border. Article 7 of the Kars Treaty provided that Turkey and Soviet Armenia, quote, agreed to facilitate the crossing of the border by the inhabitants of the bordering zones on condition of the observance of the customs, police, and sanitary regulations, which shall be established in this regard by a mixed commission. Article 8 of the Kars Treaty provided that inhabitants of the bordering districts needed, quote, to make use of summer and winter pastures on the other side of the border and agreed to accord these inhabitants the right to cross the border with their animals and to avail themselves of the customary pasturage. Furthermore, yet another article, Article 17, provides that the parties will, quote, assure free transit of persons and commodities without any hindrance. These are all clearly violated by Turkey's blockade. One could argue that Turkey has a greater interest in ending the blockade because it's undermining the very treaty that it relies on to enforce the Soviet-Turkish boundaries. Armenia would not be the only country in the region to question Soviet-era treaties. Other countries in the region, including Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan, contest the validity of Soviet-era treaties. For instance, during the Soviet period, there were treaties signed with Iran, dealing with Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan over Caspian rights. And all these countries contest these treaties today. We may also want to look for guidance through the International Law Commission's articles on the responsibility of states for international wrongful acts. Article 41 provides that states shall not recognize as lawful a situation created by a serious breach, such as genocide or a crime against humanity. Therefore, third parties have an obligation not to recognize as lawful fruits of an egregious criminal conduct, like a crime against humanity or a genocide. These obligations that third parties have to not recognize the fruits of genocide as lawful may explain why third party states, like the United States, have been putting extreme pressure on Armenia to sign the protocols, for instance, because this would mean that Armenia was acceding to its losses and that the third parties were not complicit in it. We should also look to Article 64 of the Vienna Convention on the Laws of Treaty. As international human rights attorney and Armenian Genocide Reparation Study Group co-author Alfred Desaias points out, it calls for the overruling of codified treaty provisions, even if the treaty is valid, if, subsequent to a valid treaty, a new peremptory norm is created which would be violated by the treaty provisions. This is worth further exploring. Before moving on, I want to talk about the American Lausanne Treaty. I think its fate is useful in understanding the enduring legacy of the Sèvres Treaty and how the United States established relations with Turkey despite strong opposition from its legislative branch. The United States was not a signatory to the Lausanne Treaty. They created their own treaty to establish relations with Turkey, and that is the American Lausanne Treaty. Significantly, this treaty was never ratified by the U.S. Senate, despite a multi-year intensive effort to get it approved. The agreement was signed by President Coolidge in August 1923, but after many attempts and much lobbying, when they tried to pass it in 1927, it failed. And one of the main reasons that it failed was because of Armenia. Enough senators believed a full 6 years after the signing of the Kars Treaty that Wilson's Armenia was still valid and that the Kars Treaty was invalid. The Democratic Party platform from 1924 even condemned the American Lausanne Treaty because of Armenian concerns. The platform criticized the treaty since it, quote, barters legitimate rights and betrays Armenia for the Chester oil concessions. We favor the protection of American rights in Turkey and the fulfillment of President Wilson's arbitral award respecting Armenia. Mind you, this was 1924, after the Kars Treaty had already been signed. One of the main opponents of the treaty was Senator William King from Utah, who explained the major reason for the treaty's defeat. Quote, obviously, it would be unfair and unreasonable for the United States to recognize and respect the claim and profession of Mustafa Kemal Pasha so long as he persists in holding control and sovereignty over Wilson's Armenia, now a no man's land, while nearly a million Armenian refugees and exiles are a people without a country. So the next question is, Armenia had these rights, but have they waived them? Have they acquiesced? Article 45 of the International Law Commission's Articles on State Responsibility precludes a state from making a claim if the injured state has validly waived the claim, or if the injured state is to be considered as having, by reason of its conduct, validly acquiesced in the lapse of that claim. So we need to examine Armenia's conduct to see if they have waived any claims for reparations. Immediately after the genocide, Armenia was a captured nation of the Soviet Union, which was unable to conduct an independent foreign policy. After its independence in 1991, Armenia's Declaration of Independence addressed the issue of justice for the Armenian genocide in its preamble, noting, quote, aware of its historic responsibility for the destiny of the Armenian people, engaged in the realization of the aspirations of all Armenians and the restoration of historical justice. Furthermore, Article 11 states that the Republic of Armenia stands in support of the task of achieving international recognition of the 1915 genocide in Ottoman Turkey and Western Armenia. Did the protocol signed between Armenia and Turkey in October 2009 waive Armenia's claims? Despite heavy pressure from Turkey, Armenia did not explicitly recognize the Kars Treaty. The protocols did recognize the, quote, existing border between the two countries as defined by the relevant treaties of international law, but it did not recognize the Kars Treaty. It left open to interpretation what the relevant treaties were. Armenia also fought successfully against signing the protocols on October 13th, which was the anniversary of the signing of the Kars Treaty. Turkey had tried very aggressively to have the signing ceremony of the protocols be on October 13th, but they weren't. In addition, the Armenian Constitutional Court decision on the protocols narrowly interpreted, quote, the common border clause of the protocols, indicating that Armenia was simply making a commitment to resolve legal, organizational, and institutional issues connected to safeguarding the operation of the border checkpoints. Also significant was the court's ruling that only those international treaties that have been ratified under the constitution of the present Republic of Armenia could be considered legally valid. The implication being that treaties ratified before the independence of the Republic, like the Kars Treaty, were invalid. The The Constitutional Court also held that the protocols do not contradict Armenia's Declaration of Independence, which discuss Western Armenia, and the need for historical justice. As we continue to grapple with the legal avenues for redress, let us remember that in most cases dealing with genocide reparations or mass human rights violations, political as well as legal mechanisms were instrumental in their resolution. They worked together, hand in hand. In the United States, federal courts initially rejected claims for reparations for interned Japanese Americans because in 1944, the U.S. Supreme Court held that their internment was lawful. It was only after government documents were declassified and showed the government had lied about the need for internment that momentum was created for the ultimate political process of Congress passing a law providing for reparations. Also in the United States, tobacco companies felt compelled to pay significant penalties after they were forced to confess they had been lying to the American public for several decades about the health dangers of smoking. Another factor that is observed in many of these cases is a perpetrator state that wants to atone for its sins. Armenia faces incredible difficulties trying to negotiate with a party who does not recognize a genocide, or at the very least, that wrongs were committed. Working for justice for the Armenian genocide is indeed daunting. But it is important to remember Professor Henry Theriault's words, however. He states, quote, "What is striking about the persistence of historical efforts like the civil rights movement in the United States or Gandhi's struggle for Indian independence is that these demands came from great material, political, and military weakness, and yet still succeeded because of the moral strength of the position of the weak vis-a-vis the strong. Moral legitimacy is a great force in geopolitics, and it is the reliable ally of the weak, oppressed, and marginalized. It is because of this force that those committed to power politics ridicule those who believe in moral legitimacy in the hope that they will stop believing and thus be tricked into giving up the most powerful tool of change. It is Armenia's one advantage today. Moreover, progress is being made. We must continue using political, public relations, and legal efforts to realize justice. Decades of outside pressure and resolutions have kept the Armenian genocide relevant to current affairs. And as a result, more and more Turkish writers and intellectuals are discussing Turkey's responsibility for the genocide. Cemal Pasha's grandson, Hasan Cemal, even published a book about the Armenian genocide and called on Turkey to end its denial. The grandson of one of the three perpetrators. Over the past several years, the Armenian genocide is being commemorated in Turkey and no longer just in Istanbul. The discussion for reparations has actually even begun in Turkey itself. In 2010, the Ankara Freedom of Thought Initiative held a conference where Turkish intellectuals talked about the need to pay for reparations. The Armenian genocide was a criminal act, not only against Armenians, but humanity. The obligation to work towards accountability for this crime does not fall on Armenia alone. In fact, the Genocide Convention, to which the US, France, Germany, Russia, Turkey, and Armenia are all a party, obligates states to prevent and punish its violation. In addition, Article 3 of the Convention declares that complicity to commit genocide, along with the act of genocide itself, will be one of the five acts punishable by the convention. So even if you don't commit the acts, but you help aid and abet them, you can be liable. In fact, states which aid and abet Turkey's denial of the Armenian genocide and its efforts to evade accountability are violating their obligations under the Genocide Convention. In the International Court of Justice's opinion in Bosnia versus Serbia, Judge Lauterbach, in a separate opinion, explained, "The duty to prevent genocide is a duty that rests upon all parties, and it is a duty owed by each party to every other." Turkey has a strong interest in a just resolution, since its failure to atone for this crime continues to mar its relations with its most important trading partners, with the US and Europe. It was in large part because Germany paid reparations for the Holocaust that it eventually became a respected power and leader in international relations. Turkey will not be able to play the role of a respected regional power until it comes to terms with the Armenian Genocide and works towards a just resolution. Thank you.
I would now like to invite all of you to ask any questions to Ms. Nahapetyan in regards to the issue spoken of today.
Kate, thank you very much for that wonderful lecture, very enlightening. The Kars Treaty had, from my understanding, had a limited time for its effectiveness. And I think recently when there was an issue between Russia and Turkey following the downing of one of the warplanes, the Russian warplane, that Russia played that card that at any time they could call the Kars Treaty null and void, because that particular, I think it was for about 20 years that it was supposed to be effective only. And it's basically renewed on a yearly basis. Could you enlighten us on that?
Yeah, that's another very good point, that there, it's not in the treaty itself, but supporting documents call about the requirement for to be renewed. I believe it's not every year, but maybe 20 or maybe 40 years. That is true. But that's yet another argument that we could use, and also another pressure point for Turkey.
After over 100 years since the Armenian Genocide, what exactly does justice look like, or would justice look like today? You've mentioned property, you've mentioned territory, but how practical is it to, I suppose, transfer territory or property to the Armenian people or the Armenian nations? And I particularly ask this question regarding territory itself, with so many Muslims living in what was old Armenia. How expedient would it be to transfer such territory to our republic?
Mm-hmm. Well, the purpose of the genocide was to annihilate the Armenian people. So I think when we're talking about reparations, the goal should be to allow for the Armenian people to thrive. And that's something that we would negotiate with Turkey. And that could include territory. I think it definitely requires Armenia's access to the sea, so they're not they're a more viable state. And it definitely includes a Turkey that is not teaching its children denial, that is will be a partner and not an aggressor. So these are things that would have to be, I believe, negotiated. There's not, you know, one way of doing it. But I think the ultimate goal has to be to ensure a viable Armenia that can thrive and is not threatened by Turkey or its neighbors.
Thank you for your lecture. We all hope for a miracle with a change of attitude by the government of Turkey. Would you say it now looks more promising or less promising because of what's happening in Turkey right now, and what we now have virtually a dictatorship, mm-hmm. without a parliament and all power in the hands of the president?
I think in some people have argued that, well, in one way, that let's go back 10 years ago. No one could have imagined that you would have a major political party in Turkey not only recognizing the genocide, but having that as part of their party platform, as the HDP did. So who knows what's going to happen in the next 10 years. But some have even argued that when you have a Erdogan, that it's impossible. You know, he's trampled on human rights. He's prevented people from, you know, having the public space to discuss these issues. But on the flip side, when you have such a strong popular leader, he's able to declare, and if he wanted to, he could agree to reparations and have the power to do it because he's so powerful. But the issue is, does he have that interest right now? And I don't see it, but who knows what's going to happen. Some have said maybe if he gets pushed into a corner, he'll see that as a way of taking some of the pressure off. But it is, it doesn't look very good right now with Erdogan in power. But at the same time, you have a political party in Turkey calling for recognition. So that's a positive development. You have both things going on.
Following up from Fred Nile, Reverend Fred Nile's comment, I think the critical point also captured in your lecture is that treaties are useless unless other countries do something about it. I think the key problem here is Donald Trump congratulated Erdogan. Our federal government does not recognize the Armenian genocide. In this context, what's your opinion?
Well, that was the problem we had in the 1800s even. It's a recurring problem. You have these rights, but people aren't willing to enforce them. And the thing is, there have been instances where countries have taken their border disputes to the International Court of Justice. So that is something Armenia could do. But you would first have to have... So you do have a mechanism to determine a border dispute. That mechanism is there. But you would first have to get Turkey to agree to that jurisdiction and Armenia to have the confidence to bring that to the court. So it's not something unique to Armenia, but still we have these laws that allow us some roadmap to resolve our conflicts. But at the same time, power does very much influence how these treaties are enforced. But these questions surrounding the Kars Treaty, which are based on international law, if you didn't have these treaties, if you didn't have international law, Armenia wouldn't have anything at all to try to bring Turkey to the table. And it is because of these treaties, declarations, that you do have a Turkey that is trying, you know, came to the table and signed the protocols, even though Armenia didn't explicitly recognize the Kars Treaty, for instance, even though they knew that Azerbaijan would be very upset. So it's not totally without influence.
Do you think, given that Turkey has delayed for about 100 years or more, or, as you already described, recognition of the genocide, would any kind of increase in positive relations practically force Armenia to, say, relinquish a right to reparations, or how do you see relations moving forward positively in the coming years?
Without recognition, or...?
Well, not necessarily as a first stage, but would there be have to be, say, a relinquishing of war reparations? Like, do you think that would be a necessary stage for the Turks to accept positive relations to develop? I'm asking what your opinion on that is, there.
This is a question I think the Armenian community faced for centuries, is are by being compliant, by bowing down, will we have some kind of good faith, goodwill in return? And the answer has always been no. And so I think we need to learn from that history, that when the Armenians were known as the most loyal minority, and yet, look what happened. And they were compliant. And I don't think that would help. I think it's also, you see it not only happening to Armenians, but other minorities in Turkey itself. You know, there was a saying during the genocide that the Armenians would tell the Kurds, they're having us for breakfast, they're gonna have you for lunch. And I think it's important, not only for Armenians, but for the whole region and the whole world, is to force Turkey to account for the genocide. And we don't do it by being compliant. I don't think that's going to encourage them. We haven't seen that play out. With the protocols, again, is another example where the Armenians said they had a very compliant position, which is, you know, you don't have to recognize the genocide. We're not asking anything of you. And they signed this treaty. And the response within days was to indicate that they had no intention of abiding by it. And it was a ploy to dodge the bullet of Obama, because Obama had made a solid pledge to recognize the Armenian genocide. and it was the first year for his April 24th statement, and the protocols were announced 2 days before April 24th and gave President Obama a very nice excuse to not recognize the genocide, and that's exactly what he said. He said, you know, we have the protocols going on, so we're not going to upset that process. We think there's a lot of potential here. So I think it's a valid question to think, you know, well, you know, how maybe if we are less demanding, it would help. But the history has shown that that has not been the case. And I haven't seen Turkey react that way to anyone. By actually, for instance, Donald Trump, President Trump, he didn't recognize it, and Turkey responded. And their response that day, or I think it was the next day, was to start bombing our allies, the Kurds. And in the case of the Uyghurs in China, Erdogan accused the Chinese of genocide against the Uyghurs. It was a couple of years ago. And the Chinese responded forcefully back, said, you know, how dare you say that? And within a week, Erdogan said, oh, I'm sorry, no, I didn't mean that. So just like, you know, if you bring it down to a bully in the playground, they generally don't respond. It just encourages their aggression when you're compliant. You have to stand up to them. The problem is Armenia doesn't have as much resources to, but I think it's better that they do work with what they have.
So thank you very much, Kate. If there was a situation, say in future, that let's say we have open borders with Turkey and maybe trading agreements, etc., before the recognition, would you encourage that?
My personal opinion, I think that would, but explicitly maybe reserving the right, not relinquishing the potential for reparations in the future, leaving that open. For example, with the Holocaust, they received reparations, and they used those reparations to gain strength, and then they continued to ask for reparations in the future as they got more resources. And that's something Armenia could do, where they have the end to the blockade, gain strength, gain resources, and then when they're in a stronger position, work towards reparations and justice.
Thank you, Kate. You touched on a point where you used the word bully, and you made reference to China and how Turkey backed off. Geopolitically, how can Armenia bully Turkey by using the allies of the Sevres Treaty, as they were back then, currently? How can we stand up and bully them back, using modern geopolitical means, especially America? When you look at what Donald Trump recently said to try to pacify the dynamics in Korea, in North Korea, by saying, well, China's got that under control. How do we use our allies, whether it's Russia and now hopefully growingly America, to bully Turkey?
Well, I think Armenia, as their foreign policy becomes more independent, you're seeing an exacerbation of the patience of the Western Europeans and the United States. And the fact that they continue to support the Kurds despite heavy pressure from Turkey is a sign that Armenia should be prepared for potential, you know, border changes. And that's another reason to, you know, study these issues carefully, because I do see that in the next 20 years, it's not inconceivable and maybe likely that we're going to see a Kurdistan or continued movement towards that. And just as, you know, these laws can be, then these treaties can then be used as a justification for helping Armenia gain access to the sea, for instance. But I see, as As long as Erdogan's in power, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, I see a very independent-minded foreign policy that's not going to jive with the United States and Western Europe, and they're going to continue supporting the Kurds. And maybe eventually that could mean a changing of borders, and Armenia should be ready to make its case as those borders are being changed.
Kate, I had a question. Mm-hmm. In regards to countries like Czech Republic recently acknowledging the genocide, does countries such as those that don't have as much power in Europe or the region, do countries like that who recognize the genocide impact justice and the future of Armenia?
Yes, actually, if each court, I mean, each country has its own court system where you could potentially pursue genocide-related reparations issues. And a country that has, even a small country that maybe has recognized the genocide, it's going to be easier to pursue these claims. I don't know how the system in the Czech Republic works, but in the United States, there is precedent for suing countries in U.S. courts for human rights violations. So even if a small country has recognized it, maybe that's going to open up the potential, depending on their court system, for bringing claims there. And also it just builds momentum as well. When a smaller country recognizes the genocide, it also shows an example of, you know, well, if a powerful country like the United States can surely do this, if a small country like the Czech Republic is able to.
Okay, just a question. As you know, last year the German Bundestag recognized the Armenian genocide and recognized its own complicity in the Armenian genocide. Do you see that as a legal avenue in which where matters of reparation can start perhaps out of the box through Germany while Turkey gets its act together and its democracy together and its own history together? Do you see that as a path forward as well, given that we have now a powerful European state recognising a genocide and recognising its own complicity? What avenues do you see there?
Yeah, I think that's a very important new development, because this is, I think, the first time that a country has recognized their own responsibility. So it's something that we're looking more into, to see how the German courts, if they do allow for these kinds of claims. Or another, I guess, hopeful sign is that Germany has a history of, a proud history of coming to terms with atrocities committed. They've done it before. In the case of the Hereros, they're actually working towards paying reparations for them. This is a tribe in Namibia that Germany was responsible for committing a genocide against them in the early 1900s, even before the Armenian genocide. And Germany is in negotiations with Namibia right now to pay reparations. That's a situation where Germany had a first-hand responsibility for committing the atrocities, not aiding and abetting. But it's important because this is an atrocity that happened before the Armenian genocide, and the Germans feel compelled to try to work towards some kind of means of reparations.
Okay, thanks for your time. So you've mentioned Trabzon is a key area for Armenians to be able to open ports in order to help the economy. Is there any kind of foresight as to how much that does help the economy at all? First part, and then I'll try to remember the second part of that question.
Well, I think the issue is, as a landlocked country, you have very limited abilities to trade, and it's so crucial to have a seaport. And that's the pressure that Turkey has, in a large part, is because Armenia is landlocked. And if you had access to a seaport, that would enable it to have more independence and for the economy to grow as well. Because right now, it's hard to trade when you have a closed border and you don't have access. One thing, the potential is, you know, there where Armenia could, even if they didn't have complete dominion, they could have a treaty where it would give them free access, and the area to that port would be demilitarized, for instance. That could be make it more feasible.
And then with one of those resolutions, in a perfect world, how long does it take for it to actually come to fruition, let's say if it was resolved today?
If an agreement was made to pay reparations?
How long would it take usually in today's world for something to take full effect?
Well, if it's monetary, that could happen right away. The changing of curriculums would, I guess, be slower. You know, you'd have to draft the curriculum, have it approved when it comes to ending genocide denial. When you're talking about maybe access to the sea, that's going to take a lot of time and negotiations, creating commissions to look at that issue. So that could take months. But depending on how many resources you put into it, it could resolve within less than a year.
You seem to, in the beginning of your lecture, you said politics and human rights go hand in hand. But we seem to, when politics is involved, we don't seem to get reach fair and just justice, you know, to the people, whether it's Armenian or whatever genocide is happening. That's my first question. My second question is, Erdogan today is mistreating, killing, massacring its own people of different ethnic backgrounds included. And the world is sitting and watching. Why isn't something being done to it, to a dictator, the president of the country, who is actually mistreating and killing its own people? I think 850,000 was quoted the other day. Was it 150,000? I think, sorry.
Yeah, I think it's 300,000 have been displaced, mainly the Kurdish, in the Kurdish populated areas. Well, when I was talking about how we have to work on several fronts, which is public relations, political and legal, I was talking about how in the case of many of these instances for getting reparations for historical injustices, they used all three fronts. They didn't rely solely on the legal case. In the case for the Holocaust, they started with litigation, but they eventually were also negotiating with the Swiss government when it came to Swiss banks. And they also involved Congress. They had hearings on the Swiss banks and the dormant accounts. They had reports that were written. So that's what I meant, is that we shouldn't just simply rely on just the political front or the legal front. We need to work both. And on public relations, it was ultimately, you know, the Swiss and the insurance companies, when it came to the Holocaust, they could have won based just solely on legal grounds, because so much time had passed, for instance, but it was the public relations that forced them to settle. None of the cases actually resulted in a court ordering the reparations. They eventually settled, and part of it was because they had a very good public relations campaign that made it too embarrassing for the Swiss banks or the insurance companies to fight tooth and nail on the legal front and make all the legal arguments.
Thank you. The question I had was around if, say, going back to Oren's point, you know, reparations happen, this decision's made, the capacity of Armenia to deal with this sort of influx of economic benefits and non-economic benefits, how do you feel that Armenia is able to or not able to deal with that, and how would we as the diaspora support that sort of a end point? Like, how do we start supporting that end point from now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Are you talking about ensuring that the funds are distributed equitably and with that?
Yeah, or just, you know,
funds coming in, the ability to either manage and hold on to funds?
Well, what you could do is create a fund that has overseers who are from the diaspora and from the Armenian government as well. That's something that was done in the Holocaust as well. The diaspora community had a role in realizing them, and they had a role in how they were distributed. And so that is a very complicated effort, but I think it would be important as a unifying force also for the Armenian government and the diaspora to work together, is if we had this partnership where we would eventually see how the funds are used.
I'll just get the last question over there.
On that note, the diasporas globally have this prioritization of recognition in their political lobbying efforts, and they see lobbying as the most effective mode of engaging with the issue of genocide recognition. Two-part question. How effective and how useful has the diaspora lobbying effort been in progressing these goals? Is this an effective path for diasporas in countries with strategic reliance on Turkey, such as the United States and Australia, which is more historical, rather? Or have these political paths been exhausted? And what do you believe diasporas can do to be more effective in their utilization of resources? And how should we direct these efforts to see reparations granted and to improve the lives of our countrymen?
Well, I think the issue of recognition is and justice is not something that would be just beneficial. It's crucial to Armenia's survival. It's a national security issue. Because as long as you have an unrepentant perpetrator of the genocide next door, Armenia is in danger. And it should concern Australia and the United States. When I met with National Security Council staff, I would tell them this was after the April war in Artsakh. And we came to them with photos of decapitated people and civilians with their ears cut off. I said, this is no longer a theoretical issue. We're seeing it happen again. And it's because you continue to think of Turkey as in, what should we do this year? And what should we do next, you know, this year. It's always a one-year plan. And you haven't thought about, what do we do about Turkey for the next 10, 20 years? That we have a Turkey that is not a reliable ally. And there is movement in Turkey where you have people talking about it, risking their livelihood to discuss it, where you have a political party that is part of their platform. You would not have this if we weren't talking about it from without. And people within Turkey have a much more difficult time talking about it because they risk their livelihood, and in the case of Hrant Dink, their lives. So I think we have a duty to do it outside. And in Turkey, you know, in the United States, we haven't passed the resolution in the Congress. But throughout these efforts, we've raised awareness and we've raised a cost for Turkey. And with that cost comes an interest in trying to resolve it. And it's no accident that you have Erdogan issuing statements now, although they're still filled with denial, they're at least starting to make a statement. That's another very important development. It's no longer just a political party, but you have the leader of the country issuing statements, expressing condolences. This is nowhere near what it needs to be, but it is a step forward. And again, you would not have this movement if it wasn't for the diaspora communities raising these issues. And Turkey knows that they can't, okay, they've maybe been successful in preventing the Armenian Genocide Resolution from passing, but when they want legislation in their favor passed, they know that they can't get it through because of the Armenian American and Greek American communities. For instance, they tried to pass a law that would give Turkey preferential treatment to invest in Native American lands in Turkey. I mean, in the United States. And it was an innocuous resolution. They thought it was going to easily pass. but we were able to stop it. And it only passed by, you know, it took out the provisions allowing for Turkish preference for investment. And Turkey wants to, when the EU was negotiating a trade agreement with the United States, Turkey was trying desperately to be included in that negotiation process because they know that if there was a US-Turkey standalone trade agreement, it would never pass the US Senate, and that's what it needs to do. So we have enough political power to prevent those kinds of provisions from passing. So thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Could you all please be on together? Can I extend a special thank you to the staff in the Premier's office and the New South Wales Parliament for their assistance in today's organisation. Can I please also welcome the Honourable Reverend Fred Nile, MLC, to close this evening's commemoration with a prayer.
Thank you for the opportunity to close in prayer. Before I do, I'll just say one or two words. I was very pleased, as it was mentioned by David, to have the motion moved acknowledging the genocide of the Armenian people after meeting with the leaders of six political parties from the left to the right, so that the motion would be passed unanimously and then finally again passed by our state assembly. This is on our state political level. Our upper house is like the state senate. And I encountered Turkey's response. I had a letter then from the Consul General of Turkey saying how unhappy they were that this motion had been passed and I would no longer be a welcome visitor to Turkey, and especially to the Gallipoli celebrations, which are commemorations which are very important for Australians. She didn't know I'd been there the previous year and had visited all those places, so I wasn't heartbroken over her decision. But I must confess that the new Consul General has gone out of his way to be my friend and has come to see me and wants to have further meetings, not discussing anything in particular. It's on a human relationships level. I thought, well, that's an interesting development, positive one. So we thank God for those opportunities and for his guidance. So in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we thank you, O Lord, for this opportunity to meet and to consider these very important issues, and especially to remember our brothers and sisters who died in Armenia during the Armenian genocide, the 1.5 million innocent men, women and children. And we just pray now that as they are in glory as martyrs watching us, they will not be disappointed in our attitudes and our efforts, even on their behalf now. So I just pray that the blessing of God, the Father, Son and the Holy Spirit will be with each one of you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.